The Midweek Drive Team, four words which signify quality and all that's best in audio entertainment.
Astounding research by Mental Health UK has uncovered the fact that over a third of adults have experienced high or extreme levels of stress in the past year, which means we could well be having one in five UK workers needing to take time off work due to poor mental health caused by pressure or stress. Now, of course, there is a post-pandemic impact to this. There are a number of other factors that come to the fore in any case, cost of living crisis, etc. But to address some of these concerns about burnout and sheer exhaustion, we're delighted to welcome to the programme the head of workplace mental health for Mental Health UK. That's Claire Neal. How are you, Claire?
Good morning, Alex. Hi, I'm very well, thank you.
Well, it's good to hear, but I mean, I wonder how often when people actually ask that question in response to it, they're actually covering up the fact that, well, they're not well at all, actually. They're under an awful lot of stress and they just don't want to actually sort of share that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a typical British response to the question. And we do find from our report on burnout that one of the statistics, for example, is that 35% of people wouldn't be comfortable to tell their managers that they were experiencing high stress. And this is one of the things at Mental Health UK that we're keen to encourage workplaces to focus on, making the workplace a safe space to say when you're not feeling okay.
I mean, certainly there are other factors as well that come into play, such as obviously fear of being or appearing to be incapable, and obviously then leading the way to redundancy, all sorts of other aspects, etc. But share with us, what does burnout generally mean? Because I use the phrase exhaustion or the word exhaustion. Is it simply a case like that, or is it a case of, well, actually, the signs are a lot more subtle?
So, yes, both right. So exhaustion definitely plays a part in burnout. Burnout isn't a medical diagnosis. It can be described as chronic stress that has significant impact on our physical and mental health if that stress isn't successfully managed. But just feeling tired isn't burnout. Burnout is normally aligned with feelings of detachment from your work, feelings of self-doubt. And these are things that happen on a frequent basis, not just a one-off. And the thing with burnout, it's a gradual process. It can creep up on us. So it doesn't happen overnight. And this is why being able to talk about it with you today is we want people to understand that we can all be vulnerable to it. And if we don't look after our mental health on a regular basis, this is something that we're all vulnerable to.
We suggested some of the causes of possible burnout in the introduction. I mean, things like cost of living crisis, general work stresses and strains. But you know, what generally is driving this? I mean, is it also a case of, you know, something as basic as fretting about the socio-political state of the world and wars in other countries and so on?
Again, it's very individual, but the survey that we carried out showed that workload is making up about 45% of our respondents' reasons for feeling burnt out. There's also bullying in the workplace can contribute to this feeling of burnout in the workplace. And another significant result was that people were feeling lonely and isolated. So those are some of the workplace factors. But on the personal level, as you say, cost of living crisis, we're in unprecedented times at the moment. So political uncertainty, global challenges are all fueling feelings of stress and hopelessness, which again, all symptoms that can suggest burnout.
So let's move into the employer situation. I mean, I'm shocked to hear you say that bullying is still an issue. I mean, I had hoped that we'd actually, in the 21st century, began to move away from that, unless we're talking about more subtle forms of bullying, in which we're actually talking about the way in which you're looking at targets being reached, assessments being produced, and so on and so forth, which I suppose could be addressed within that. But what can employers do to actually help their staff stay healthy and, more to the point, productive?
Brilliant question. And these are some of the points that I really wanted to get across today. So we know that line managers play a really important part in creating workplaces, mentally healthy workplaces. So Training your line managers in mental health awareness is really, really important. Line managers need to feel confident and comfortable having these conversations around mental health and making the time to have them. So training your line managers is one really, really important one. Having robust bullying and harassment policies in place is another key ingredient, I think, to this healthy workplace. And also having access to professional support so that people can seek help from clinicians if they feel that they are going down a route of poor mental health. I would also, sorry, but one last thing about resources. Mental Health UK have a lot of free resources on our website, which can help people have supportive conversations around mental health.
Is there any particular occupation which is more susceptible to these kind of pressures, or is it a case of it doesn't matter whether you're actually in the health industries, whether you're actually in education, whether you're actually in manufacturing, these things can actually impact you at any particular time in your career?
Yeah, it can be very individual, so it's hard to make a sweeping statement. I know that we've recently spoken to at a large accountancy conference, and there has been research to show that accountancy is struggling in this area. And also, you've mentioned healthcare, teaching as well can be sectors where burnout can be particularly prevalent.
And technology, does it actually help? Because clearly, one of the things we haven't mentioned, I mean, apart from the cost of living crisis and the post-pandemic world and so on and so forth, and political changes, is of course the fact that artificial intelligence and chat GPTs and all of the technology is there, which clearly people might feel stressed if they can't get a handle around how to actually utilize the technology, or they feel as though the technology is going to be replacing them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we all know since the pandemic there has been an increased use of technology, and there's anxiety about what the future holds with these developments, good as well as bad. But in reference to technology, I think the important thing when it comes to burnout is that we are operating in an always on culture, and being unable to switch off can really contribute to this chronic stress. So that blurring of boundaries between our work and our home life is definitely a factor.
Is there light at the end of the tunnel, Claire? I mean, clearly we've been discussing this particular report from workplace health, workplace mental health, and so on. But do you think as though, if we take some steps to put in place that we might actually see a reduction, or are we doomed to kind of be in a never-ending spiraling wherever, either upwards or downwards?
Oh gosh, no, I would hate to say that. I have to say I've worked in the field of workplace mental health for over 20 years, and what I would say that's really positive is there is a definite increase in willingness for organisations to talk about mental health. More and more people are opening up about it. And if we open up and we foster this culture of empathy and authenticity, and we role model good mentally healthy behavior at work, then we're more able to help people and nip problems in the bud before they become too serious. So no, I do think people are recognizing the importance and taking steps to look after people who are struggling.
Yeah, we clearly need more Claire Neils in the workplace. Claire, where can people go to find out further information about the survey and indeed workplace mental health?
So you can visit our website, which is www.mentalhealth-uk.org, and we've got lots of free resources and access to the report on that website.
Claire Neil, Head of Workplace Mental Health for Mental Health UK. Many thanks indeed, and stay healthy, Claire.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
Nearly 6 in 10 of us apparently don't know or aren't even sure how to check if a travel agent, a tour operator, or a holiday booking are legit. That seems as though we're going to be taking Russian roulette to extreme circumstances when it comes to actually booking holidays. And so we're delighted to be able to welcome to the program today somebody who can certainly address this whole notion of avoiding the scammers and indeed taking a hard left with respect to that. Of course, it's travel writer extraordinaire, and indeed a general all-round broadcast journalist, wonderful, wonderful person that is Simon Calder. How are you, Simon?
All good. I just wish I were in beautiful Lincolnshire, one of my absolute favourite counties. And I haven't been there for a while, so I must get back soon.
Indeed, it's high time you returned. But let's talk a little bit more about this particular notion of fraud and scams with respect to holiday deals. Is it a case of we're just not listening to the fact that, if a deal sounds too good to be true, it probably is?
Well, look, there's a bit of that. Now, of course, there are some fantastic deals around in travel, and that's part of the problem. That's something that the scammers capitalize on. So before Christmas, for instance, I went to beautiful Tirana in Albania, and I paid £30 return, which just seems ridiculous. But there we are. It was a legitimate deal that I booked direct with a reputable airline, so I knew I was going to be okay. But what the scammers do, particularly at this time of year when everybody's booking holidays because they are desperate to have something to look forward to, and that's absolutely perfect because anticipation of a holiday is one of the key ingredients of it. But the cost of living crisis, credit card bills have come in for Christmas. It's a really difficult time, and the scammers will come in with deals that are so tempting. And that's why, according to this Nationwide Building Society survey, a lot of people are simply one in three are going to say, "Yeah, I'll book that. I'm not going to check." Quite extraordinary, and it's so important that people, particularly because, of course, the people who are desperate, most desperate to save money, are exactly the people who can least afford to lose it. So, yeah, be very careful. If a deal sounds too good to be true, then I tell you what, there's nothing wrong with going back to your lovely local travel agent, sitting down with them, looking through the possible options. They'll find you a good deal on hopefully a proper package holiday. Again, for that, you get perfect consumer protection and you know that you're not going to be scammed.
I was going to mention that, Simon, because is it a case of we've become so used to accessing our information online, etc., that we forget that there is still a human element that can be contacted to actually ensure that the scam isn't taking place?
Well, yeah, and look, here's the big problem with travel. It is uniquely vulnerable to scammers because, of course, you only take delivery when you turn up at Manchester Airport or you arrive at the villa in Greece or Portugal or Italy or wherever it is, and you discover that there's actually somebody staying there. So you're paying a large amount of money up front, and normally, of course, that works absolutely a treat. But people are desperate to get away. They want to make up for lost sunshine during the COVID pandemic. They want to bond with their family. They just want to dream of sunny skies and a glass of something lovely and chilled at that taverna by the Aegean shore. That's all completely understandable, but please just take your time and watch out for red flags such as, "Oh, is this exactly the deal I need, exactly the week I want? A beautiful villa at a price which is half anybody else is charging." Well, in that case, yes, it almost certainly is way too good to be true. And the other important point is if the organization you're dealing with may or may not be a scammer, but if they demand money by bank transfer, that should be a big red flag, okay? Because sending money by bank transfer is like giving a bag of your hard-earned cash to somebody you've never met before, and you need to be really careful and think, "Would I actually go round and just give this person a bag of my cash? I don't know. Let me make a few checks first."
It can be a minefield, certainly, to actually navigate ourselves through this never-ending sea stream of information, etc. I mean, some of the tips you provided there, Simon, obviously make perfect sense. Is it a case of obviously we need to just take time, as we would with any financial decision, to actually think long and hard about, is this the right one for me? Because, of course, the writing and the persuasion and the techniques that are actually used by scammers is getting more and more sophisticated and more targeted on a daily basis, it would seem.
Oh, sure, yeah. And so much of this coming in on social media because 40% of people in the Nationwide survey said that, yep, they get holiday ads in their social media feeds. Now, a lot of those will be genuine, but some of them will be, I'm sorry to say, scams. I just heard of one in London where people have booked what sounded like a lovely property. Turned out that all 17, I think, groups of people have booked this, and it was somebody's house, and it was just a complete scam. program that they'd found on a social media site, and that was absolutely miserable. So yes, be careful about how and where you find the deal. We're lucky in the UK to have a fantastic travel industry with great travel agents, tour operators and airlines. And as long as I know that I'm booking direct with one of those, and I know that because I've been dealing with them for years, then that's okay. But where there's a third party involved that I haven't heard of, that nobody who I know well has recommended it, well, I'm then at that point very, very suspicious. And it can be accommodation. It can also be people who are wanting to go and see family at home. And they want a cheap airfare, and that is going to again cause you problems. If you just search online for the cheapest fare to destination X, then if it comes up and it's much lower than everybody else, again, that might be a scam. You send off your money, and no ticket ever arrives. Desperately sad.
Okay, so summary time in terms of the top tips. We've already mentioned using secure payment methods and beware of really cheap holiday offers. Booking directly with established hotels or APTA or Atoll protected companies, presumably also very much top of the list.
Oh, sure. Yeah, just to run through what those are. So ABTA, the Travel Association, formerly the Association of British Travel Agents, that's a really good sign that you're dealing with a company that signed up to a code of practice. Now, some scammers pretend to be ABTA registered, but that's quite straightforward. So you get the company name, you search online for the ABTA member checker, and then that will come up with a landline. So you call the landline and make sure that that is the company that you think you are dealing with. And Atoll protection is basically something which shows that you've booked a proper package holiday, which comes with great consumer protection attached. And you'll also get an Atoll certificate, which will give you extra security that you've bought what you need. There's nothing wrong with wanting a holiday. There's nothing wrong with wanting to book it urgently, but please just go through organisations that you know about. And Nationwide has a fantastic scam checker. You can search online for scam checker. That will give you the details of the scam checker. Nationwide give you details of the number to call, or you can go into your Nationwide branch and they will be happy to help you. They'll have a look at what it is you're contemplating, and they'll give you their professional judgment on whether this looks like a good thing or a scam.
And of course, we haven't mentioned the fact that anything that's recommended by Simon Collar as well would be probably worthwhile checking out in terms of holidays. So,
well, look, I am very, very, very circumspect about recommending any particular company. We do have a fantastic, legitimate travel industry in the UK, and I'm a very avid consumer of their products. So just make sure that you're dealing with a reputable company. You've got loads of choice, and it's all fantastic. If you avoid those miserable scammers.
Indeed so. Travel expert Simon Collar, always a delight. And hopefully maybe 2024 we'll see the time when you return to Lincoln, Simon. Who knows?
I'm very, very, very much hoping to. I'll head along to King's Cross right now.
Time for more movie thoughts, reviews, and royal commentary from Richard Fitzwilliams and Natasha Wanton on the Midweek Drive.
So, talk, shout, take command.
Who is that?
The famous Bob Russell.
In 41, you called for a large-scale march. The time has come for another.
No, Bob.
I can handle all the grunt work. Rally the young. We are going to put together the largest peaceful protest made up of angelic troublemakers such as yourselves.
My friend, Dr. Martin Luther King, will be joining us.
How many bodies did it take to surround the White House?
How many? Sorry, I thought that was a setup for a joke. You literally want me to find out?
When it comes to the old guard, I'm considered a pariah.
Every person at this table will be in the line of fire because of him.
Why is everyone so obsessed with what I'm doing and with whom? How can you preach salvation and not want to save yourself?
Every day, we surrender that which makes us different.
I can't surrender my differences. The world won't let me.
The day of your march, the entire DC police force has been mobilized.
What they really want to destroy is all of us coming together and demanding this country change.
I remember saying that this Rustin fella is a little crazy. Only later did I fully comprehend that a little didn't even come close.
We intend to go there not by the thousands, but by the hundreds of thousands.
Yes!
We are committed to altering the trajectory of this country towards freedom. That's what's on the line. Nothing less.
Lord, I hope and pray they come today.
Well, it's often said if Martin Luther King were actually with us today, there would be lots of things he'd have to say about life and so on. And of course, his famous I Have a Dream speech, which I think most folk would actually say, yes, I wish we did have that dream, as opposed to the divisiveness that sometimes tends to impact contemporary politics. However, a recent Netflix movie that's creating not necessarily waves, but I think is well worth a watch, is indeed going to be considered and duly analysed by Richard Fitzwilliams. Go, Richard.
Well, firstly, my confession. I had never heard of Bayard Rustin. This is a biopic, which it certainly opened my eyes. I mean, there are obvious reasons for this. There are reasons which the movie goes into in quite a lot of depth, but predominantly, I mean, everybody knows of Martin Luther King and I Have a Dream speech in 1963. And I mean, it's become legendary. What people don't know is the name or details, in most cases, of the person who prepared. I mean, a quarter of a million people arrived at Washington, D.C. to protest the civil rights, and it was Bayard Rustin who was the organizer. He was the force, so to speak, behind Martin Luther King, who, of course, was the inspiration and, of course, was the voice. And, of course, it's very, very interesting if one reads how the I Have a Dream speech actually arose and so forth. But this movie is concentrating on Rustin and also why he has been largely, well, you could say almost airbrushed. And at the time, this was something that, again, was hypersensitive, because in the 1960s in the United States, if you were in the 40s and the 50s as well, if you were gay, it was nightmarish, and indeed it could be. And it's interesting that we've also two biopics, one about Leonard Bernstein, Maestro, and again, Bernstein and Rustin shared one thing in common. They were not only gay, but they were not prepared to go through the process, even if they didn't officially come out in a statement, of hiding it. So this could cause not only a good deal of embarrassment for those who are trying to play this down, but also, of course, and this is what comes across in the movie, in the politics behind the huge civil rights march, it was perfect for your enemies to use against you. And Rustin had plenty of enemies. We see Jeffrey Wright, the black congressman from New York, he plays Adam Clayton Powell, who was the congressman, who was very devious and very, very against Rustin and didn't want him involved. And also we have a supporter of Rustin's. Glenn Terman plays A. Philip Randolph. He was behind him. And then there was Roy Wilkins, played by Chris Rock, of Academy fame, no less, most particularly, of course, who was deeply afraid that the fact that Rustin was gay would cause a real problem for the enemies of the march. So there's a lot of, one of the interesting aspects of this is the extraordinary logistics behind it. The movie is one of its strong points, directed by George C. Wolfe, is that you get an idea of you know, this something this size, and most people, and indeed a lot of liberals, didn't believe that African Americans could organize anything like this. And it really was a phenomenal success. But you get an idea, not only the politics behind it, you get an idea of also the infighting, the fact that Martin Luther King had to distance himself at one stage, completely disowned Rustin. Amal Amin, it's not as good a performance as David Oyelowo is the Luther King in Selma, but it's a good performance nonetheless. And one of the aspects of this biopic that's interesting, that's his personal life, that's been fictionalized. The two lovers we see in the film, Tom, played by Gus Halper, and Elias, played by Johnny Ramey, these are fictional. What in reality happened is to some extent glossed over. The reputations of individuals involved with this are still sensitive. So it gives you an idea of rampant homophobia in the United States at that time, and also racism, and Rustin had suffered from that. But he was a supporter, proponent of Gandhi, and had the nonviolent movement, of course, in India, and had a great deal of influence on Martin Luther King. So this was an eye-opener to me. It's a very good, it's well-made, well-photographed biopic, and you could argue it doesn't reach enormous heights. But there are a lot of biopics at the moment. There was, of course, Maestro, which I mentioned. And there was also one recently discussed the very week I saw it, of the of October the 7th, of Golda Meir. And we've got Oppenheim.
We'll have one on Vladimir Putin before too long, I'm sure. And Alexander Zelensky.
Actually, Alex, that's an interesting idea, and I think you could go and film it in Russia. You know?
Well, who knows? Who knows where we could be led? It's either that or Benjamin Netanyahu, one of the two. Ideas.
Another interesting subject. Yes, indeed, he is indeed. But no. Rustin is well worth seeing, and also for me. I had no idea of a lot of this, and I'd also forgotten the size of the march and the fact it was completely unique. So if you're interested in the technicalities behind something of this scale, this is the movie for you, because I find biopics very interesting. I like the genre. So for me, it's an eye-opener, but also it's well-made and it's extremely well-acted. Coleman Domingo has rightly been nominated for an Oscar for a first-rate, very sensitive, extremely good performance, but they're all good.
Natasha Wanton, back in the day when Origins of Modern Britain featured the civil rights movement and the Vietnam scenario and the way in which that impacted on life in the UK in the contemporary world, is this something which will connect with your good self, or is it a case of, since moving to the Southern Hemisphere, frankly, you've got no interest whatsoever in American history?
I think there's a lot to be said about human history, full stop. And I mean, if we look at Australians' history, there's certainly homophobia and racism still rampant.
Natasha, I've told you, you should not have spent Australia Day defacing the James Cook Monument. I said it was not a good thing to do that.
It.
So what were you doing?
I mean, that's a whole other can of worms of controversy there, Australia Day in itself. But let's not go down that rabbit hole. I'm really glad Richard's brought this one up. This is a really fascinating piece. I haven't seen the whole thing. I've only seen like clips of it that I've gotten hold of that they've sort of released online. But it's really hooking me in. I love the kind of nitty-gritty background, and okay, you hope that like 90% of it's true. If not, obviously it can't all be true, but you hope the majority of it is true. But the acting in it, I think, is excellent. I mean, I can see why it's going to the Oscars. I think, yeah, it's very, I'm going to get very emotional and very wound up, I think, watching it, which I think is kind of the point as you're kind of watching. You're meant to get annoyed with the unjustness of some of the stuff I've seen. But so it's one of those ones where you've got to sort of watch maybe in a certain mood. But I love this sort of biopic theme that we're getting at the minute. I think that that's really interesting. And what that speaks to about us as a society at the minute, I'll leave up to the listener. But no, bring on more biopics. I'm all for it. And yes, Vladimir Putin, I would watch.
I mean, arguably Napoleon also a biopic, but that's another issue for another time. If we actually look at the notion that history is simply one system of beliefs replacing another system of beliefs, maybe it will be true, Fia, that we can look at Prince Harry now getting on down with the management and presidency of Jamaica and Barbados in a way that actually sort of, you know, connects all sorts of wonderful things for us. Anyway, Fia, is Rustin one for yourself, or have you checked it out already?
No, I'm very curious about this film. Like Richard said, like everyone knows the speech, but we don't know the full story, I think. So it's very interesting to hear, like, what he, like, he's such an interesting activist, and he's like the source behind this speech. And now we finally get an insight into how this actually happened. So I'm very interested.
And Anna Coscanel, or flagging the flag for Bucharest and Romania and so on, albeit based in Lincoln, England at present. What's your thought on this? Is it one for you?
Well, at first, I think it's, we all know that the 50s, 60s and 70s were quite hard years for the gay community and for the Black community as well. And being part of both must have been insane. And being able to put together things and appear publicly and also say all of these things with all the backlash that was probably happening at that time, it was quite hard. And I think it's something that happens to this day to both communities. I mean, we all know that as well. And I haven't watched it. I've only seen the trailer, and I read some reviews on The Guardian and some other sites. And I even though I haven't watched it, I saw that it got 3 out of 5 stars, and the reviews weren't quite lengthy. They were like half a page, not even half, which I think is a shame, because especially history needs to be discussed more and to have opinions on that. Everybody should have an opinion to say what they think, you know. And I haven't watched it, but I will, because I'm really intrigued why it has 3 out of 5 stars in some places, and why the critics say it's a good film, a good movie. So I'm curious on why is this discrepancy going on.
I suspect Richard's giving it an 8 out of 10, but
that is, I hate agreeing with all your points so far, but you're right.
Well, you know, we move from that to a character who, of course, was very popular with respect to Harry Potter. And that, of course, was Hedwig, Hedwig the Owl. It's a different Hedwig that we've actually got in the latest scenario, but it is something which actually apparently had the director Jonathan Glazer borrowing techniques from reality television with a hidden crew and fixed cameras. What's he making the film about with Hedwig, or rather the wife of Rudolf Huss? Well, perhaps it's all about Auschwitz, and maybe it's not the Twilight Zone, but it is a zone of interest. Richard.
Yes, indeed. Jonathan Glazer, a British director, and nominated the Oscars, which is also, I think, significant. It's based loosely on a Martin Amis novel, and you begin, I mean, this is the zone of interest, and it's a chilling film, putting it mildly.
If you can't have a piece of calm next to a concentration camp, where can you have a piece of calm, basically?
Well, next to the concentration camp at Auschwitz, where millions were murdered, as we know, much of the film is set in the so-called dream home of the family of the commandant of the camp, Rudolf Huss. There is absolutely no question it's an extraordinary film, and the whole idea, the concept, is rather amazing. It's interesting that the way the film begins and also the way the film ends, both of which are surprises, neither of which are being revealed here by me, but it should encourage people to see it, because it is an extraordinary film. I mean, in 1943, Huss lived with his wife. Huss is played by Christian Friedel. His wife is played a very, very good performance here. Sandra Huller, who has been very widely nominated, in fact, nominated for two BAFTAs, one for Anatomy of a Fall and the other for this. And their home is indeed, for them, idyllic. It's right next door to the camp. And you can hear all sorts of strange sounds. It sounds like people being shot or people screaming.
Noisy neighbours, Richard. Noisy neighbours.
And they are indeed noisy neighbours. And indeed the family, the host family, use the prisoner's belongings. And, well, Hedwig's particularly interested in her garden. It's got a greenhouse. It's rather amazing. The opening sequence in this, as I say, I'm not revealing, but the second part of it, where you meet the host family, you hear birds, insects, there they are, fishing and swimming and so forth, and servants catering to their needs and so on. Did you realise, of course, what's going on very soon? And a new crematorium is being built at Auschwitz. One of the strengths of this film is that it doesn't dwell on the horrors that we know. The only scene in the camp actually is a close-up of Huss himself, and you can hear the screams, you can hear the shots, you can hear what's going on, and indeed there is also the case that so often what is horrifying, people could argue, depending on how you respond individually to this, what you see more horrifying than what your imagination, knowing what's there, conjures up. A question that, I was asking myself, I have to say. Hoss is an expert on, in his particular, shall we say, sinister and macabre field. He's actually being appointed to deputy inspector of all the concentration camps. That means he has to locate. So Hedwig's aghast. She loves the family home and begs him to let her and the children stay. So, he applies, and this wish is granted. Her mother comes to stay, but sees some very, very disturbing things and leaves unannounced at night, leaving a note which is quickly burnt. The way this film progresses, and the fact that Huss becomes in charge of the operation to transport hundreds of thousands of Jews from Hungary, part of it tells the story we know. Part of it also gives this insight into his family life. And that makes it all the more macabre, especially since Glaser, as I've indicated, both begins and ends the film in, shall we say, unusual ways. You could say that his wife Hedwig is lazy, venal, very family-centered. She's interested in her garden mainly, and using what she knows. She knows exactly, of course, what's going on. And there's a servant who's, in fact, a local Polish girl, threatened with being turned to ash if she doesn't do what she's told, and so forth. There's no doubt at all that this is a macabrely effective film. It's imaginative. There's a very good performance by Christian Friedel as Hoss. How you measure a psychotic, how you measure someone who's, a sort of monster in human form, this isn't my field. But I have to say as well, when he's promoted and there's a spectacular party in one scene in the film, spectacular indeed, with a huge swastika bedecking an opera house.
It was meant to last for 1,000 years, Richard. That was the whole intention of the Third Reich. In fact, it only made it past 5 or 6 is irrelevant.
Indeed. It's a very clever, very imaginative, horrific film. And because it is, or has been handled as it has been, that is the reason for the tremendous interest in awards and so forth. So, it is remarkable. It's horrifying, of course. And if you do any reading around it and just the statistics and the detail, there's nothing really you can put into words that can describe it adequately.
And yet still we fail to learn with Rwandan genocide, with what's going on in Ukraine, with what's happening in Israel, and of course Gaza Strip as well. However, given that four of us are either children or grandchildren of the generation of the war scenario on this particular aspect, Anna Koskinen, any thoughts on the zone of interest? Is it a case of, well, you know, there you go, it was a lot better when Vlad the Impaler was actually doing things quite simplistically about the whole basis and ignoring the notion of turning people to ash, he just impaled them on sticks. And then asked
well, that I'm not going to say that that was something else, but the story is quite different there. I think that history will always repeat itself because people never learn from it. And that's the thing with history. If you look back even 1,000 years ago, things repeat themselves, but on different fronts. And people want power. And when you give someone and when you put someone in the middle of somewhere and you give them power to do something, they will do it. Probably not in the beginning, but eventually they will do something because they want to be in control, everybody. And there were so many, how are they called, investigations conducted in this sense and trials and everything. And they put people and they saw that they react similarly. And after they were taken out, they were like, I never did that. But it's the power that people want. What I think of this movie is it's obviously a drama and it's going to be, as I think Richard described perfectly, as horrific. So I think I'm not going to say it's something interesting to watch because I don't think the term interesting is something we can refer to this or attribute to this. I don't know what term should be attributed to that, but I will watch it most definitely, this one. But I don't want to say that it's interesting. I want to say it's something that we need to watch.
And Fia from the Netherlands, whose recent call to arms and mobilization against Russia, Japan, China, and other sort of countries, etc., has been echoed by our British government and outgoing military leadership as we look to prep for World War III. Any thoughts on yourself on Zone of Interest?
Well, I hope we don't go to World War III that first. No, but this film, I watched a trailer and it's just, oh, it's such a horrifying film. And just seeing this garden, it's such a beautiful garden, and she walks through it and she's like, oh yeah, no, I grow this here and it's there. And then you hear the sounds of the people. How can you convince yourself to let you and your children live there and let that just happen beside you? Just, it's crazy to me. And I just can't really understand it. So, I mean, and also the way this film was filmed, it's very interesting to see how it was quite like normal films. You really feel like you're inside the film. You really like in with the characters, and this it takes more of a step back, and you just watch it from a bit further away.
Like so, Big Brother.
Like
Big Brother, looking on.
Yeah. So I'm not sure, like I agree with Anne. You can't call it interesting, but I do want to watch it just to see how they explain it or show this horrifying part of history.
I suppose, Natasha, it's a bit like having an Alan Titchmarsh series set next to an abattoir or a slaughterhouse in terms of similar scenarios. But again, any thoughts on yourself? Is this one for you, Natasha?
Firstly, poor Titchmarsh. What's he done to annoy you, Alex? Secondly, to answer Richard's question, I think that what you imagine is definitely worse than you see. I think anything you can conjure up here in your head is definitely going to be worse. This is an exciting movie. Probably not a good adjective to decide to describe it with, but I am excited because I love it when we sort of get these little glimmers of different, these little creative, imaginative sort of pops in the cinema where not everything's always the same whitewashed action nonsense. I really want to see this movie. I love the fact that it's done in that documentary style where it's like Big Brother style, and I feel like that's really fitting and sort of haunting, but really sets the tone for what I think the director was trying to portray. And yeah, I'm absolutely hooked. I want to see this movie.
I just feel very sorry for the reputation that it's reputational damage it's done to Hedwig the Owl in obviously the Harry Potter series, but perhaps that's
can
a...
I,
yes, Anna?
Can I just add, I just looked it out. It's called the Stanford Experiment, what I was talking about, and it was conducted in 1970s, and that was what I was referring to as, you know, being wanting power. You don't have it, and it's given to you, and you're going to do imaginable stuff.
Yes, indeed. People were actually given the opportunity to actually electrocute the respondees if they gave the wrong answer or the incorrect answer. And it just demonstrated that Americans themselves could actually be persuaded to go down a line of basic sadism if indeed the motivation was actually there and so on. I'm suspecting, Richard, you're giving this a 9 out of 10. Not quite a perfect 10, but are you going for a 9?
I was debating whether it was going to be 9 or 10. Alex, I've decided on 10. I mean, you know, you're getting there. I mean, it's you know, it's a, we're going to have to find something to argue about at some point.
I just like to use the powers of the cosmos to connect with that, much as in the same way Backstairs Billy could have actually done the same thing with respect to the late Queen Mother. And I'm pleased to see, Richard, that you're still actually secretly looking to get the reputation of Prince Andrew, obviously the Duke of York, put back to restitution, shall we say, given that, of course, Backstage Billy is performing at his theatre, the Duke of York's theatre in London.
I was wondering how you'd work that one, Alex. I was turning in my mind as that sentence was coming out of your mouth. I was trying to work out where I'd said anything that in any way or any form could be...
Go, Andy. You know, he should return in the same way as triumphantly as perhaps President Trump might.
Well, I have to say, Backstairs Billy has just finished its run at the Duke of York Theatre, and it got packed audiences. It deals with William Tallon, known as Backstairs Billy, who was a member of the Queen Mother's staff at Clarence House. Indeed, was from 1978 until her death, was steward and page of the Backstairs. And this is a comedy, and it's what happens when the Queen Mother entertains some dotty guests, and also it brings in William Tallon's private life because his gay escort boyfriend, a person of colour, it is a poor person, a point of importance here, because such is this level of comedy that he can be confused with a member of a visiting African delegation, which explains his presence. If indeed this might offend you, there are notices in the cinema, the theatre.
Trigger warnings, that... Richard, trigger warnings.
There are, yes, that this is a film, the set in the 1970s, set in 78, so it might offend sensitivities these days. Now, this made the Daily Telegraph 2 days before it ended, so someone must have noticed. There was one notice that I noticed. It's only relevant in the sense that it's a badly written play, and quite honestly, you've got Penelope Wilton as the Queen Mother. You'll remember her from Downton Abbey. She's very good. She does her stuff. She's a good comic actress. She's a very good actress.
And Prime Minister Harriet from Doctor Who, of course.
That I didn't know, but it shows how versatile. No. She's nothing wrong with her, and indeed with Luke Evans as Backstairs Billy. He's got a very adroit comic touch. The trouble is that the script, the play, isn't really very, very good. Indeed, the
But is
last...
it just very good, Richard? It doesn't have to be very, very good. Is it just very good?
Yes, that's true, Alex. And indeed, what we find here, I mean, quite honestly, there are corgis that appear quite frequently. Now, the moment...
Is that a euphemism, Richard?
Such as is the fondness that the audience, when I saw it, felt for these creatures, these lovely furry animals, the moment they rushed across the stage, and they make several appearances, well, there were ahs and oohs. Now, if you've got that sort of audience, it's not too difficult to play to it, I suppose.
When the in problem... doubt, if you've got a lousy script, put in furry animals. It'll always win.
Except that furry animals can leave calling cards, Alex, and when backstairs Billy disgraces himself because his boyfriend has been discovered in the environs of Clarence House in the part in which the Queen Mother uses for entertaining, how does he redeem himself? Well, am I allowed, Alex, a spoiler? Because this is such a low.
You always give spoilers, Richard, so why should we break the habit of a lifetime?
That is not only a lie, but you didn't intend it to be true. Well, he pretends at the end, the final scene, beware, and close your ears if you don't want to hear this. He pretends to be a corgi. He has to pretend, yeah. Because he's got to do penance. And he picks up one of the droppings of corgi dropping, and
Steal comments.
As to wander around the stage on his hands and knees, pretending to be a corgi, because, you see, he's then done penance for the Queen Mother. Now, quite honestly, if a script is as bad as that, then it's just ridiculous. But, yes, I mean, if you've got a couple of comic performances that are rather good, and, I mean, the audience loved it. And, I mean, whether they were awake by the end scene, I don't know, but the facts are everything gets a standing ovation these days in the West End. I mean, it's got rather silly, but the moment the play ends and everyone starts standing up, well, that's not the way it should be.
Did you stand up, or did you actually maintain your integrity?
The latter, Alex, the latter. I did not, as you have gathered, I'm not an admirer of quite
dogs
honestly.
Pooing on stage. Well, you know, that's okay. I don't like people vomiting on screen. It's part of the world.
Well, I mean, there was a horse, apparently, when Gone with the Wind was staged many, many years ago as a musical. I can see Natasha has covered her face, which is a most appropriate gesture.
That was where the line, tomorrow is another nay, came from. Basically,
My Sundays wouldn't be the same without you guys. I'm just saying.
I agree.
Especially when it goes out on a Thursday. Never mind. Anyway, carry on, Richard. Dignity, always dignity, as they said in the joyous movie Singing in the Rain.
Well, we've also got the Oscar nominations, Alex, and we've got the big controversy over Barbie. Now, here's the thing.
But before then, Backstairs Billy, is it a 4 out of 10 for you or even less?
It is a 2.5 because it pleases the audience it wants to reach. That's very, very generous, quite honestly, because it's not well written. But the acting is perfectly adequate.
Early in the year, Fia and Anna both fought for Oppenheimer and said it would be a disgrace and a travesty if Barbie was to actually win out over Oppenheimer. I'm pleased to see that the impact and influence of our Dutch and Romanian correspondents has actually impacted the Oscars, because thankfully they've actually eased back. And although Margot Robbie has got Best Producer nomination, and likewise Greta Gerwig's also got a nod in the direction of some things, they're not in the main running. So well done, Fia and Anna. That's what I say.
Best Producer nomination. What is that, Alex?
It's an Academy Award that is there. If you look at it, it's what Margot Robbie has been entered for.
I have to say that was not the main interest has been the issue of Best Actress and also Best Director. Frankly, Barbie was never going to qualify for Best Director because the way the Oscars are voted for, everybody in the two rounds, everybody votes for Best Picture, but various sections, the directors, the actors, and so on and so forth, vote for their particular segment in the way this has been worked out. There are about 600, I gather.
And Richard, we know that it's going to be Killers of the Flower Moon that'll win Best Picture. So why sort of bother with any kind of other connections on that basis?
As you know, Alex, very well indeed, it is not going to be. It is going to be a triumph for Oppenheimer. But I just wanted to explain, because Ken gets a nomination, the Screen Actors Guild Awards will be interesting, because Ken gets a nomination with Ryan Gosling for Barbie as Best Supporting Actor. Margot Robbie doesn't for Best Actress, and the point is, of course, that Barbie has that it's brought in $1.5 billion at
yes,
the box.
Yes, but there's more to life than money. Look at Zone of Interest. That's not going to actually get, you know, billions of dollars.
Alex, you don't need necessarily to convince me, but I do have to say that regarding Best Actress, I think it is weird that Margot Robbie didn't get a nomination, simply because much though I liked Annette Bening as an intrepid swimmer, and we remember we discussed this some months
Naiad,
ago.
Naiad.
But nonetheless, you had Carey Mulligan and you had Lily Gladstone, you had Sandra Huller, and you had Emma Stone.
And Lily Gladstone will win because she is a former Native American actress who was given her first break by our two colleagues, Randy Reinholtz and Jean Bruce Scott. So doubtless she's going to win.
She, yes, and I think that is. I would have difficulty in choosing between her and Emma Stone, I would add, for Poor Things.
Yeah, we know so, your Poor Things obsession, Richard, but let it go. It's a Frankenstein thing.
Objection, Alex. It's not an obsession. I would say that I got most of the nomination predictions right, almost all of them, actually. And it's going to be exciting for Best Actor, because what we've got is Cillian Murphy for Oppenheimer against Paul Giamatti. Wonderful comic performance, as we've discussed.
It'll be Mr. Murphy. And you know, that's all I shall say. As we have to draw to a close this particular aspect by saying, sorry, Natasha, did you want to have a brief interjection?
I was just saying, I see what Richard's point is about the absence of Barbie in there, and I was quite surprised with it as well, but not so much from the acting perspective, but for the side roles. I see that it was nominated for Best Costume, which I don't think it will sadly win. I think Napoleon will. But I was surprised that it wasn't nominated for things like hair and makeup, which I thought was done really well. So I feel like it has been done unjustly with some of the nominations.
Well, let's
not that I think it deserves to win. Like, I love Oppenheimer. Not that I think that it surpasses like a serious movie like that. But I do think that it's been unjustly sort of prejudiced against with some of the choices for the selections.
Let's hope that Ridley Scott can find a role for Barbie in the upcoming sequel to Gladiator. I'm sure there's a role for Gladiator Ken in there, if nothing else. To Anna Koskinen, to Fia Vandenberger, to Natasha Wanton, and as ever to Richard Fitzwilliams, many thanks. And keep watching those movies.